And good evening and welcome to Bird Calls from the Knoll Foundation Studios here at Red River Radio. Tonight's program is made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana and is brought to you in part by the Piney Woods Audubon Society of Nacogdoches Lufkin, educating people and protecting birds for over four decades. The Piney Woods Audubon Society is seeking new members and meets the first Thursday of each month, September through May. Information is on Facebook at East Texas Piney Woods Audubon. We invite you to call in with your questions tonight about our feathered friends and the avian world at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Cliff Shackelford is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and he's ready to take your questions about birds. Cliff is currently the statewide ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, a position he has held since 1997, and he's been an avid bird watcher for more than 30 years. He's also the author of the book Hummingbirds of Texas, published in 2005 by Texas A&M Press, and he has authored more than 80 publications on birds and birding. He and his wife, Julie, and their two children live in East Texas. And Cliff, thanks again for joining us once more.
Hey, Bill, it's a chilly evening tonight.
It is, and I'm just wondering, we're expecting freeze conditions tonight. We'll talk about how that may affect migrating birds as they come through this area.
Good.
But first, we give the numbers out again. You can call in with your questions tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question regarding birds in our avian world are fair game. And Cliff, we ended last month's show with a conservation tip. Can you refresh our memories?
Right. Every episode we end with a little tip on what you can do to make life easier for wildlife, and namely birds. And one of the big killers of birds we have data for is strikes against windows and buildings and high wires. We know that. And so if you've got a window that's a problem, we encourage you to help do something about it. Because birds and windows don't mix, and that's what we talked about last month. That, you know, birds, when they see the reflection in the glass, it looks like blue sky and white clouds and green trees. And to them, it just looks like a breezeway. And so, boom, they don't realize that that's glass and they hit it. And often they might seem like they're going to make it, but a lot of times they flutter off or wander off into the bushes to die of serious internal injuries. So it's senseless death if you've got a window at your house or your office. There are products you can do something about it. We mentioned to go do an internet search for the American Bird Conservancy site on this topic of window kill, and there's products that you can get to fix your window that won't mess up your view of the window, and it'll make it a lot more bird friendly.
And Cliff, as we do every month, we profile a species, but let me give the numbers out first again. Folks, you can call in tonight during our show with calls and questions at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And every month we profile a species. And what do you have for us this month?
So today we're profiling the American coot, which is also known as the mud hen, or when you're in Cajun country, the pooldoo. So let's listen to the non-musical sounds of a small flock of American coots here.
Sounds like a bunch of people in Toledo cheering for the mud hens up there. So.
Yeah, lots of chuckles and burps and other strange trumpet-like sounds that the coot makes. These birds are blackish with a short white bill. The species is duck-like. They spend much of their time on the water, and they often will flock with ducks, but taxonomically speaking, it's not related to our ducks and geese. Instead, coots are related to gallinules, rails, and cranes. One big difference between waterfowl and coots is that waterfowl have webbed feet. If you're lucky enough to see a coot walking on the shoreline, you'll notice their huge feet have lobed toes, so very different from webbed feet. We have a photo on the Bird Calls page at redriverradio.org, snapped by James Childress of Lufkin, and you can see the big feet and lobed toes on James's picture. This is a game bird. It's not what I'd call a prized game bird among hunters. Hunters most often take them, waterfowl hunters, when their beloved ducks aren't flying around. In the Red River listening areas, you'll see them mostly in the winter and often in immense rafts. Such rafts involve hundreds of birds huddled together on the water. Anglers will see them most often out on the big water where an occasional bald eagle will swoop down trying to nab a coot for an easy meal. Coots are mostly vegetarians. They will dive for food or dip down to grab various vegetation, including hydrilla, but unfortunately, they don't appear to be fans of one of our biggest wetland plant plagues, the giant salvinia. Very few coots stay with us year-round and raise young. Most of them head north to breed. But we do have some that stick around in the listening area that breed in small numbers. In order to take flight, coots must get a long running start and almost appearing like they're running on top of water. And this explains why coots often get stranded in small bodies of water that lack that long runway of water that would allow them to get aloft. And I've seen many roadkill coots on bridges over reservoirs where low-flying coots, probably in the fog, didn't get enough lift before crossing the busy roadway full of fast-moving vehicles. In nighttime rainstorms during migration, coots and other water birds sometimes crash land on parking lots and metal rooftops with a thin layer of water that can shine in the darkness at night looking like a pond, which would normally be a good spot for a migrating coot to retreat during a storm. Such crash landings, though, can result in injury or even death. And that concludes a little insight into the life of the American coot or the pooldoo.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. We are taking your calls and questions tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question regarding birds and our avian world are welcome. And Cliff, we have a couple of guests with us tonight, so we'll open it up for some other questions as well.
We're very excited tonight to, we're going to call this the Game Warden episode because we've got two game wardens here tonight that are going to be answering questions for folks that want to call in and have a question about law enforcement. We do ask that it stays bird related. We don't want to really talk too much about deer and redfish and bass and those things that are not birds. I want to introduce Troy Parker with Louisiana Department of Wildlife and Fisheries. He's just down the road here and works this parish here where we're broadcasting from and several other neighboring parishes. He's got a big area he covers. So Troy's been with Louisiana Department of Fish and Wildlife for about 17 years, and we're happy to have him. And also we've got Scott Robertson with the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. He's got about 6 years of service, and he offices out of Marshall. And I'm real excited about Scott. I wanted to mention that his grandfather was one of my college professors.
Oh, okay.
So Scott's a second-generation skip one of wildlife biologists. So his grandfather was one of my professors and also on my thesis committee and signed my thesis when I finished. So that's pretty cool. So really excited to have Troy and Scott with us tonight. And we've got some questions to kind of get the ball rolling here, but we really want to hear from you, the listener. If you've ever had that looming question in the back of your head about birds and law enforcement, this is your night to clear the air. We've got experienced guys from both sides of the Sabine River, and we will find out that sometimes the answer will vary depending on what side of the river you're on. So there are different rules and regs in Louisiana that are different on my side of the border in Texas. So we might cover, we might hear about some of those differences. So what I want to do first of all is welcome you guys. So Troy, tell us a little bit about the parishes you work in.
Thanks, Cliff. It's good to be here. Yes, sir. I work Region 1, which consists of all seven parishes of the northwest part of the state. Caddo, Bossier, DeSoto, Webster, Red River, Bienville, and Claiborne parishes. I mainly stay on the Bossier, Caddo, and DeSoto parishes because it's divided into two districts, District A and District B. So, and of those three parishes, there's a lot of water. There's a lot of rural area. Been here for 17 years. Went to school down just south of here. Graduated from Northwestern State University. So kind of a native to this area. Kind of know it real well. I work with some of the neighboring parishes and with the neighboring state of Texas. And so it's really a good thing to see the different areas and different perspectives of what's going on. So it's just been a great time and enjoying what I do.
Yeah, great. Well, we're glad to have you, Troy. And Scott, tell us a little bit about working for TPWD and where you're based and what area you have to cover.
Well, I'm out of, like you said, out of Marshall, Texas, in Harrison County. And we're my district composes of about seven counties, from Tyler to Harrison down to Panola County. So we kind of work that whole area, but I'm primarily working in Harrison County. It's about a 915 square mile county, depending on where you look. Pretty rural county. Like Troy said, lots of water, lots of rural areas. We work with Louisiana, at different times. Just like he said, we enjoy what we do.
Yeah. And it's kind of neat that you guys, you know, share some areas that it's fuzzy. It's a gray area when you're on Toledo Bend, for example, or Caddo Lake. You really sometimes don't know when you're out on the water, well, am I on Louisiana waters or Texas waters? So it's neat to hear that you guys do a lot of cooperating where we have shared ground like that, or shared water.
Yeah, we try to stay abreast of everything that we know that the Texas laws require, because we're always getting questions. And the first thing that I do when I'm on a body of water, well, I look at the registration. If they're from Louisiana, then it's kind of like, well, you should know. But if they're from Texas and they're in Louisiana, well, I don't know. So yeah. We try to keep lines of communication open, whether by cell phone or radio, whatever, with these guys. And works pretty well, and help out each other. You know, sometimes there's just lots of questions that I can't answer for Texas, and the same way with Scott. He doesn't know, so we'll get on the phone and ask and work together, try to, you know, come to an agreement on what needs to take place.
Yeah, good. Cool. So, Bill, you've got some questions there.
Yeah, but first I'm going to give out the numbers. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and he has a couple of guests with him tonight, and we're taking your questions at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. This could be a fun question. It's, what is the most bizarre phone call you've ever received, or most unusual scene you've ever stumbled upon out there in the wilds?
I guess I'll go first there, Cliff. I was thinking about that on the way, and I was probably working. I've been on about 7 years, 6 or 7 years, and I got a phone call from a management area park ranger. He said, "Man, you're not going to believe this, but one of our campers has a couple of talons on his dash with bands on it. I think you need to get here." Well, depending on the time of day or the season, I'm liable to be 5 miles or 105 miles away. Just so happened I was close. It was up in North Bossier. I get there, and sure enough, there's two brothers that were camping, literally camping in their truck. And it was dark. When my lights hit their dash, I saw the talons, and they literally had bands, probably looked like watch bands.
Mm-hmm.
And they were, I guess, you know, frozen or whatever they do to purify in a claw like position. And so I get the brothers out. Well, I asked them to get out of the truck, because I just kind of wanted, for safety, to make sure everything was okay and ever good. Well, the one didn't move, and I kept telling him, "Sir, get out of the truck." And his brother finally said, "Well, he can't. He's you know, paraplegic, he has no legs." And I'm like, "Oh, okay, well, I'm sorry about that. Stay right where you are, I'll come to you." And so anyway, long story short, it went on. They were actually just pretty much what we would call traveling brothers that slept and camped all around the world, all around the country, mm-hmm. that they could drive. And they had been in Michigan, and because I asked them, I said, "Well, where did you get these talons?" I had no idea what they were. Never seen anything like that before, and I'm talking, they were huge. And they said they got them in Michigan, and they were at a place that was known for eagle nesting. and eagle roosting.
Mm-hmm.
And they had just stumbled on this under a tree, stumbled on them, and so they decided they'd pick them up and keep them. And I said, really? When he said eagle, I really started paying attention, and I immediately got on the phone to a federal agent that I knew, called him up, gave him the numbers, and in about 10 minutes, he had me an answer. And sure enough, they were bald eagle talons with bands.
Wow.
Well, needless to say, they didn't keep them, and they got my autograph because they thought they were all right. They thought, well, we found them. And yeah. I said, well, regardless of how you came about, you're in possession of a non-game bird parts and pieces that's federally protected. Mm-hmm. So, needless to say, we seized them, made the case, and I hadn't seen the brother since.
And we've covered that in past episodes where bird parts are protected, and that we have game wardens that will look at flea markets and or get calls from people at flea markets because they see that there's a bouquet someone's selling of flowers, and they'll spritz it up with some blue jay feathers or cardinal feathers. Well, that's a no-no. So the message here is if it's a bird part, don't keep it. It can be – if it's game bird, you can have that curly Q of the mallard on your hat. That's fine. That's a game bird. But if it's a non-game bird, like Troy is mentioning with the bald eagle, and talons, for those that are listening, those are the bird feet. Those are the claws. And so and I mentioned that to Scott on the drive here that – in my early days, that was one of the calls I got working with a Texas game warden. Was he pulled somebody over that had a pair of talons dangling from their rearview mirror, just like dice, and he pulled them over and confiscated them. And when it's a bird foot, it's kind of hard to identify the bird when you don't have the rest of the bird, probably like you are with the eagle.
No idea. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's like whose feet are these? I don't know. So I had to take those talons to a collection and match them up, and they were crested caracara feet. And so then they could start the process of finding this guy and doing restitution based on the identification of the bird.
Yeah.
So how about you, Scott? What's the most bizarre phone call you've ever gotten in the field?
I'm sitting here trying to think about that. I mean, because we just, anything and everything from, roadkill to, hey, there's an animal that's been hit. I just wanted you to know I got one of those today. But I think whenever I was a couple of years out, and actually it was, it involved my partner Troy here with the alligators that we worked together on. So, two alligators had been illegally poached in Louisiana and then brought over to Texas, and that's a Lacey Act violation. And the Lacey Act is when the game has been illegally taken in another state and then transported across state lines. So a captain in another district had put me in contact with Troy and his partner, and they said, hey, we think they're in this area. So we go, and my partner and I track them down, and these folks did not like government, did not like state government,
mm-hmm.
did not like police. And they had, they had just a little bit of everything. They had some bird feathers. They had deer, kind of there. And we were after the gators. I know it's a bird show, but they did have some, parts there we had to address. But so we get them, and we take them and meet up with Troy and his partner. And we hash out the issues on our side, and then they deal with them on their side. And but it was just a neat experience because I'd never met a Louisiana game warden before, and I know that we'd worked with them before, but I was fresh out my career, so it was really neat for us to cooperate like that on the same case and hash out those issues on both sides, mm-hmm. both sides of the river, so to speak.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and his two guests tonight. And our phone lines are open at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. 8502 regarding the collection of feathers and things like that. Now, when I was a young boy, which was back in the Stone Age, and there were no eagles back then. That was the 1960s. When did this become an issue? Because I don't remember that being a law back in the 60s or 70s when I was running around the woods.
You're talking about keeping the parts and pieces?
Yeah, Ohio, you know, feathers. I mean, we were young boys, and we'd find a feather, and it was in good shape. We'd pick it up and take it home, you know, as young boys are apt to do, you know, because you're interested in that kind of stuff.
I would think that it came about during the, you know, the Federal Migratory Game Bird Act, which not all the birds are migratory, of course, but, you know, eagles travel, hawks and all those travel, and I'm sure Cliff knows more about that than I, but I think the law has been in place. However, the enforcement of it has been pretty lackadaisical because, I mean, let's face it, you could just, back in my younger days, I used to rodeo, and every cowboy had a hawk feather or an owl feather or something stuck in his hat. You know, and of course, nobody knew any better. They didn't think anything about it. But now that I've become an agent and learned the law, you know, the famous line, ignorance of the law is no excuse. So that's been used a lot. But I think the laws have been in place about keeping the parts and the pieces and using them. And, you know, you see a lot of the, like Cliff said, the little antique shops, mom and pop, that put together things and have hawk feathers weaved in a, what they call a dream catcher. You know, but now when we talk about and discuss that, about who can possess it legally, there are our Native Americans that can, you know, that does not apply. They do their headdresses and things that they can have without permits, and that's typically legal. And to know all that, you have to do some studying, and I learned a lot just in this job, what could and couldn't be done by who. And so it's really neat to figure it out. But, yeah, you're right. There used to, people would just like the talons and the feathers. Everybody would keep them.
Yeah.
And I'm even thinking musicians in bluegrass bands, the mandolin players want a rattlesnake rattle. That's a tradition, is you put a rattlesnake rattle in your mandolin, and that's what makes it a bluegrass mandolin.
Really?
Now, this is not a herpetology show, but would that be illegal to have a rattlesnake rattle?
Well, in Louisiana it would, but I think in Texas, rattlesnakes are illegal to kill, aren't they?
So we have the eastern the eastern diamondback, which is protected, and then, but we have our western diamondback that's not. So, I mean,
figure.
You know, around East Texas, you know, the East Texas area, the easterns are protected, and but, you know, you just go to where you get your diamondbacks or whatever, you can, they have the rattlesnake roundups.
Right.
You know, so where they make anything from wallets, hat bands, they cook and eat the meat. So it's kind of depending on where that species line stops right there in the area.
Yeah. And the one that you're referring to for here in this listening area, that's the canebrake rattlesnake, also called the timber rattlesnake. So that's the one that we have in this listening area. So we did mention a couple things. I thought I'd mention that the Lasiak was mentioned. That's our, probably in the books, our oldest wildlife law. And I want to say 1900, 1901, somewhere back in there. And then to get back to the point about the bird part, so the Migratory Bird Treaty Act that Troy mentioned, that's 1918.
Right.
So that's a long time ago. And then there's additional law called the Bald and Golden Eagle Protection Act that's 1960-something.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of different things to protect eagles and bird parts.
And the eagles are finally coming back.
Yeah,
at least
and they
the
are.
Of this
that's
country.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and actually, I was leading a group of students at SFA in the wildlife lab just the other day in the middle of Nacogdoches, and we had an adult bald eagle fly over us.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, 20, 30 years ago, you would have been really impressed and still impressed, but they've made such a comeback that bald eagles are not unusual to see this day and age. But yet, it's still one of our most common calls that we get at our agency. People saying, I'm calling to report a bald eagle. I'm out here on Lake Houston or Lake Conroe, and I see bald eagles. And we're like, yeah, that's...
they're back.
Pretty common.
Yeah, we know that. Yeah. And it's new to you, but not new to us. And
Growing up in Ohio, there were none. I mean, and I remember when peregrine falcons came back and started coming back from Canada. because they were gone too. And, you know, shoot, my alma mater was the Falcons, named after the Paraguay Falcons. but they have come back, and a lot of that is because of these laws. So I'm absolutely 100% in favor of these laws because they protect this gorgeous wildlife, you know.
I did get an eagle call one time, Cliff, in my career, and a little farm out south of DeSoto Parish. It was probably around 9 o'clock at night. Just got back home, got off shift. Lady called and said that she found it in her chicken coop. And I said, well, that's probably a good place for them. I said, are you sure it's a bald eagle? Oh, yeah, it's white head, white tail. It's full blown. I said, well, I'll be right there. It couldn't fly. Got there. She had a number 3 wash tub throwed over it. And I brought my gloves and they had issued us some little catch pins. And I actually got to put my hands on a bald eagle. I thought that was pretty cool.
So it was real deal?
It was real deal. It was actually bald. It broke his leg and broke his wing diving for a chicken.
Yeah.
And I actually got to bring it to one of our local rehabbers, and they took it to Baton Rouge and rehabbed it. And I guess he's still flying around trying to get chickens.
That's cool.
So, yeah, it was pretty fun.
He was tired. He was tired of fish, I guess.
Yeah, I guess.
I would be too.
It was close to Toledo Bend because they trade there a lot.
Yeah, that's neat.
Mm-hmm.
And we do have a caller online. We're going to go to our first caller tonight. By the way, our lines are open at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question regarding our avian world and birds, or any question you have for our two folks from the wildlife departments and the game warden, they are here to answer your questions about that as well. Give us a call, 800-552-8502.
Okay, so let's talk about what's involved in the training to become a game warden. What is involved? We'll start with you, Scott, for Texas. Do you need a college degree, and what does it take to be a game warden?
Yes, sir. So you need an undergraduate degree of any kind as a prerequisite to be a Texas game warden. So mine is my undergraduate degree is in history. My partner's was in ag education, and both of us felt like we'd do more good protecting and conserving wildlife and lands of Texas than teaching.
Yeah.
And that's what I wanted to do. But got this job, and I do get to teach quite a bit. I do a lot of education, a lot of outreach, speaking events, engagements, and that sort of thing. So I am teaching in a sense, just with a badge and a gun.
Yeah.
So we're state peace officers in the state of Texas, so anything that a state trooper can do, a sheriff's deputy can do, a municipal peace officer, like a city police can do, we can enforce all the laws in the state of Texas. We just don't enforce city ordinances or county ordinances. The amount of stuff that we have to learn, it's about a 7.5 month, give or take, academy. So we learn all of those things that a peace officer would learn, and then we learn wildlife code. So that's why it's long, and that's why we have all the training that we have.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And Troy, how different is it in Louisiana?
Louisiana requires, there's 3 requisites that they, if you will, give an option to. One option is 60 hours of college credit. The other option is 4 years of post-certified law enforcement work, whether it be city police, sheriff's office, even state troopers. If you've done that for 4 years, you're eligible to apply, or 4 years of military service. And if you meet any one of those 3, you are eligible to apply. And I'm sure, like Texas, we have, academies, our academies start out with over 300 applicants, and they have to whittle them down because sometimes we only have 20 openings or what have you over the state. So basically the same thing. They make the application. If you get chosen, they offer you a job. Then you have to go through, and ours is anywhere from 6 to 7 month academy. And it's a post-certified police academy, learning every law that there is. We don't focus on the highways and traffic. We do some of that just to know. Because, as Scott said, we're full-blown state police officers, and we both carry federal commissions as well, because, of course, for the migratory game birds and then this fish and seafood industry. So You know, we regulate and enforce all those laws. Our academies, you know, go through all of that, teach all the pros and the defensive tactics, firearms, everything that there is to do. It's extenuous. It's hard. And typically in a 20-man or woman academy that's hired, 50% drop out.
Oh, wow.
So our maintenance in that is probably 50%. If it's over that, it's a good academy. So, you know, it's hard. It's definitely trying. One of the main things that they pound on us is pay attention to detail. Because when you walk into a situation, you never know. Like when I drove up on those guys and saw the two talons, like you said, without those bands, I'd have never known those were Eagles until they got sent off to someone that knew more than me.
Mm-hmm.
But just so happened they had the band. So you can't teach that in academy. You can't teach, you know, what may be else be in that truck. So, you know, it's something that you want to do.
Yeah.
When I went through the academy, that was all that went through my mind. I'm going to take this because I want to do this. It's not something for somebody that thinks, well, I'm going to get this job and go hunting and fishing every day. That don't happen.
Yeah.
And so it's law enforcement to the T, and you have to watch your P's and Q's. It's probably even more. I've had troopers tell me, I don't want your job because everybody you meet's got a gun. And that's true.
It really is true.
And even on the water, you know, we do all the boat and safety just like Texas, and recreational boaters can be worse than some of your, you know, your hunters in the woods. So,
especially if they've been drinking.
That's correct.
Yeah.
So,
you are listening to Bird Calls. We're going to try to go to Jared again. Jared, you're online with our guest tonight and Cliff Shackelford. What's your question tonight?
Yes, sir. I really appreciate this show. It's I just discovered y'all, man. It's good stuff. I'm enjoying it. But I had a question about blue jays. I've had a couple of incidents where I've had, you know, baby blue jays fall out of a nest. And what would be the recommended procedure? Who should I try to get those to if that happened again? Or,
well, let's talk about, okay, you're in White Oak, but let's throw this to Troy with Shreveport because he works with a rehabber, and let's give a shout out. Troy, what would you do in the Shreveport listening area with that?
Well, more than likely, if they seem to be still in good shape, we've got a couple of veterinarians that have gone through the process of being permitted rehabbers, or our biologists, our Louisiana biologists that's would be partners with you on our state, and I would give them a call. If you're in the Louisiana area, you can call our Minden office. If you're in this Region 1 area, you can call the Minden office. They have several biologists that work every day, and they can either come get those birds from you and rehab them, or they may give you some sort of suggestion. The thing that you can't do is you can't just rehab them yourself. You know, you have to make sure that they're getting a proper, you know, balance of nutrition and all that. And so,
yeah, and just raising kids isn't the same as raising blue jays. And I should mention there's a period of blue jays' life of the youngster where they hop out of the nest a little too soon. They're not able to fly, but they're still dependent on the adults. And that's maybe what you're seeing. A lot of people see that. And so what we tell people is, bring the kids in, bring the pets in, and let the blue jay hop around. It's just going to be another day or two before it can figure out how to fly. But that blue jay is one of the unique species that kind of flies the nest a little too soon and looks orphaned and looks abandoned, but it's really not. So I bet you when you're about to grab that baby blue jay, mom or dad's probably fussing at you from the trees above. So the best thing to do is let mom and dad finish the job, because you can really change a bird's life by taking it away from mom and dad, thinking it's an orphan. It's really not, because then humans have to raise it, and humans raise human babies, but it's really tough. And we've got this thing called imprinting, where that blue jay all of a sudden is looking at humans as, hey, I associate food with you and protection with you. And once we release those birds, it's really tough to get them to be wild and wary. So in Scott's area, you're calling from White Oak. That's in Scott's neck of the woods. Scott, did you have anything you wanted to add to this?
Well, we're a little bit different than Louisiana, because our biologists don't rehab them. So in our state, all the rehabbers, they rehab animals on their of their own volition, out of their own pocketbook. So sometimes it's kind of tough for us to actually get a rehabber to be able to care for them. So what we always try to do is up front is just say, hey, let's leave them alone for a couple of days, kind of what you were saying about let's maybe see if the parents are going to come back and take care of it, get the kids and the pets away and all of that stuff. And then if they're still there after a couple of days, then we'll talk about it and try to figure out a suitable course action, because there is a rehabber in our area. So we just make contact with her and see if she's got the room and the space, yeah, and or maybe some tips that we can make it a little more comfortable, like maybe that time period you were talking about flying back off. I mean, just basically assess the situation over the phone before we just scoop them up and put them in a box.
Yeah.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and we have lines open now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We go next to Clyde from Nacogdoches. Clyde, you're online with Cliff Shackelford and his guest. What's your question tonight?
Well, I guess I'm going to start by saying this is a wonderful show. I've been listening to it for a long time, and I've learned a lot.
Great. Thanks, Clyde.
But the question was actually brought up by your discussion of the eagle talons and the migratory and other Parks Protection Act. Mm-hmm. And I'm recalling that when I was in my explorers in Dallas about 1959 or 1960, I was in the Dallas Zoo, and they had a condor as one of part of their exhibits. And one of them had cast a feather, and the attendant or zookeeper or whatever, I was looking at it and saying, boy, that would be really neat for my Order of the Era regalia. And the fellow that was zookeeper said, well, here. Mm-hmm. And this would now be illegal, right?
Well, I'm gonna let the game wardens hear, because everything is situational. Mm-hmm. And you know, if the game warden sees that feather is coming from the zoo, that's one thing. But you're right, Clyde. If it's years later, even days later, the good thing is we don't have wild condors flying around our listening area. We don't have them anywhere in Texas or Louisiana or Arkansas.
I would call that a pity, but
yeah,
except for the regulatory
right, and actually there are historical records of California condors in West Texas. They found some remains of them in caves out in West Texas that dated way back when. That, you know, there's some speculation they could have been traded among Native Americans, but the belief is that condors used to fly in the West Texas skies, but that would have been thousands of years ago. So I don't know. Let's ask Troy and Scott. Let's go with Scott first. How would you handle such a situation, Scott?
Well, first and foremost, what you had said would apply to me, because that California condor is not in our area. So I would start asking questions and say, okay, where did you get this? How did you come about it? I mean, if they're old, then you can tell, you know, that there is that there's some age on it. So not everything, I guess, is black and white. So we have to look into it. Like Troy said earlier, we got to look at the details and see, I guess, legally, yes, it would be illegal to possess because it's a bird of prey. However, we look at it and then we'll go from there. I mean, it's one of those blanket statements that I don't like to give those because everything's situational.
Yeah. So Clyde, you're free to go. We're not going to get you. Yeah.
Well, in fact, I don't have it anymore.
Oh. Bummer.
I think my nephew, who is well, it was last known in his hands. Well, he was when he was going to OA, I gave it to him.
Mm-hmm.
But that was, you know, that was 30 or 40 years ago.
Long time ago.
30-some years ago, I guess. Anyway.
Yeah.
So And I think most of his stuff got the, you know, was lost over the years and since.
Yeah.
So I doubt that that one is a matter of actual concern right. to anybody. I mean, you know, as a practical matter, but it's it just, you know, made me wonder. I mean, you're the program, and I thought,
yeah,
would that be legal or not? I don't think it is, but
yeah.
now, but and I doubt that the zookeeper would give it to
right.
me now.
And I would say, I'll finalize if there are kids that are working on this kind of a merit badge, and you got to have a feather. You got so many game birds to deal with. You got turkey feathers, and I'm not talking about the white one we're going to eat in a couple weeks for Thanksgiving. I'm talking about the wild and wary wild turkey. You got several species of ducks. You got quail. There's plenty doves. Of birds that are
just
doves.
Go to,
yes.
Just go out to the chicken ranch.
Yeah. Yeah, but there's plenty of legal game out there that you can get your feathers from and get this done. You don't even need to worry about having right. raptors and condors. So, but thanks for the call, Clyde.
You bet. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and his two guests. You can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We do have another caller online. Gail from Marshall is calling. Gail, what's your question tonight?
Well, I'm one of those people that fills bird feeders, so I'm wondering what should we be feeding birds now, and maybe nothing.
You might want to turn your radio down in the back there.
Yeah, I am. What should we be feeding birds yeah. now in terms of seeds or whatever, and which birds are we feeding?
Okay, that's a great question, Gail. With this cold snap, it has pretty much pushed a lot of birds down into our area that are seed eaters. We've got now the American goldfinch are down. There's going to be other birds. We've already had records of red-breasted nuthatch in the listening area. I expect that purple finches are going to be coming in our area. So one of the best things you can do is black oil sunflower seed. That is a very universal seed. You know, a lot of people want to go the cheaper route and just get some hen scratch. Well, it's full of a lot of fillers like millet that not many things really eat. It's got some good stuff like this black oil sunflower in it. It's also got cracked corn. That's a really good seed. But I would say get your seed feeders ready. The cold snap is going to bring a lot of these things down. The cold snap also does other things. It's pushed out most of the hummingbirds. And that's a, you know, there are hummingbirds that overwinter with us in small numbers. And so what we encourage people to do is keep their hummingbird feeder up. So, Gail, still keep your hummingbird feeder up, because if there is a rufous hummingbird, for example, it would be looking for a feeder to survive. And this is a bird that's very hardy, can handle the cold snap, and has overwintered in the listening area before. So we do tell people to keep your hummingbird feeders up. It's an old wives' tale to take it down. People say, oh, if you don't take it down by Halloween, you're going to keep your hummingbirds here. Well, trust me, you don't have that kind of power over wildlife. When they're ready to go, they're going to go. So just because a feeder's up isn't going to keep them here, that's an old wives' tale. So instead, we have lots of hummingbirds that will winter with us, and without that feeder, and in the next few nights, well, tonight and the next couple nights, it's supposed to get down really cold. We're probably going to see a lot of the nectar-giving plants get kicked back. Lantana, Turk's cap, salvias, et cetera, are probably not going to survive tonight and tomorrow night in the listening area. So that's a lot of hummingbird food that's no more, I'm predicting. So another reason to have the hummingbird feeder up. So, but back to your main question, Gail, put out the black oil sunflower for the seed-eating birds, and they'll be happy, okay?
Okay, because I looked out, and on the gable of my garage was a pair of bluebirds this morning. Bluebirds.
Okay, and bluebirds are not going to eat seeds.
No,
so,
I'll
yep.
get the worms up.
Yeah, they're going to get the worms, and so they're going to eat insects. They'll also eat berries. So I've seen bluebirds hovering at poison ivy berries and mistletoe. They'll eat stuff like that. So bluebirds are year-round, and if you're an insectivorous bird, when it gets this cold, you learn to switch to something else pretty quick. And we see that with bluebirds, eastern phoebes, another flycatcher that will have to switch when the insects aren't flying because of cold weather.
Well, you've answered a question. I wondered if it was important, but it sounds like it's more important right now to feed birds.
Yes, I think it is. I personally don't feed, don't do the seed feeder year round. I find that we provide in our backyard what we call a wildscape, which is landscaping for wildlife. We have berry-giving fruit trees and nectar-giving herbaceous plants, and we've got cover, and that cover attracts insects, and that's what that's the food that these birds are really after. And so you have to remember that when we put out feed, it's supplemental, it's not sustenance, and that's a big difference. Think of the definition of those words, supplemental versus sustenance. And so the black hole sunflower is purely supplemental. It's not going to make it or break it for birds.
Okay.
Well,
I appreciate that.
Great. Thank you, Gail.
Thank you for being there.
All right.
Thank you, Gail. And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And he has two guests with him tonight, and that is Texas Game Warden Scott Robertson and Texas Parks and Wildlife Department Sergeant Troy Parker, who is Game Warden with the Louisiana Department of Wildlife and Fisheries. And they are taking your calls tonight, anything regarding the avian world, bird hunting, bird watching, and all of the other things that they might be overseeing. Give us a call at 800-552-8502. So Animal Planet and shows like that proliferate all across the television, has this actually worked to inform people better, these shows, about what you all do and about your purpose out there? And has it affected your job in any way, some of these shows that go in and they bring on game wardens and other people like that, just like this show, to help interact with the public? Is that something that you have found has actually made your job and life easier?
I guess I'll start on that. It has definitely brought a different angle as far as Hollywood versus reality.
Right.
And especially now during the duck season. And I love Phil Robertson as much as anybody. And in fact, I've met him, been in his home, and consider him a friend. But when that show came out and showed, depicted their duck hunting scenarios, if you will, I always chuckled because there was always a Hollywood angle.
Right.
And it's not all that.
Hollywood's got to have drama.
Oh, exactly. But it was just amazing to me how many people showed up at the duck hunting areas with camoed painted faces and long black beards and bandanas. I thought that was,
well, if nothing else, it gave you some good photo ops. I had my camera out there.
But and a lot of times they'll show things on these shows that are legal maybe on private property. And for instance, the alligators, and I know this is not about birds, but like the swamp people, when that came out, the public thought they could just go out and throw out a hook and snag a gator or shoot it with a rifle, and that's not true on public water. You can't do that. So it brought about some legal violations, and it brought about some scenarios where, hey, that's just Hollywood.
Yeah.
So you had to be careful.
Might need to put signs up in the woods. This ain't Hollywood.
Exactly.
This is reality.
But it did, and I will say this, it does help the Natural Resource Department because it gets people involved in hunting and fishing that may not have ever wanted to but saw something that kind of intrigued them and wanted them to do. So, you know, it had its pros and cons, and I always tell people, you know, if you're going to participate in the natural resource activity, hunting, fishing, whatever, just make sure you know the regulations. And our lines are open all the time at office, and I know they are in Texas. And it's not hard to find out the do's and the don'ts.
Getting it together is just a phone call away.
That's right.
So, Scott, how about for you? We're talking about those animal planet shows like Lone Star Law and Northwoods Law. I know a lot of your colleagues at Texas Parks and Wildlife have been on Lone Star Law. Have they contacted you yet?
So that show has brought a lot of light to Texas game wardens in a good way. Because most of the time when somebody says game warden, they think you're just checking a hunting and fishing license, and you walk into a deer camp and that's what they're checking. However, that's not all we do, and I know Louisiana is the same on a lot of this. We do search and rescue So when a hunter gets lost in the woods or a fisherman gets lost on Caddo Lake, which is very often, they call us. Sheriff's office calls us. If they can get out with a cell phone, I mean, that tower might bounce off of Caddo Parish. I mean, we get lots of calls from Caddo Parish saying, hey, they're there at boat row A, you know, at close to number 176. And so we'll have to go out there and go find them, especially like this time of the year. It's cold, and if they have kiddos on board. So we do a lot of that. With Hurricane Harvey, Texas responded all over the state, wherever, all over the southern part of the state where the devastation occurred. I was in Deweyville and Kirbyville for a week, and my partner went to Livingston, Texas, and then down to Deweyville as well. In different parts, and Caddo Lake flooded historically in 2016, and I spent 2 weeks of in a boat on Caddo rescuing people, making sure the looting wasn't happening, or doing our best to. So it's brought a lot of light to that. I mean, it shows our education and outreach, you know, programs. You know, we just have folks, you know, if I'm out driving or, you know, go to restaurant, get something to eat, just say, hey, I had no idea you do all of these things. I thought you just check fishing licenses. Well, we do a lot more than that. In Louisiana, right. It's the same way. They they do, you know, search and rescue and education outreach. I mean, that's education is a huge part of both agencies. I don't want to speak for you too much, Troy, but
you're doing good.
But we got to educate the future generations that are coming up, because they're going to be the future of hunting and conservation in Texas and Louisiana. And if we don't educate them and let them know the laws and regulations and just give them a friendly face sometimes to look at, they're not going to want to go hunting or go boating or not recreate with our state's natural resources. So that's a long-winded way of saying that the show has brought, you know, Texas a lot of good light, as far as we're not just out there to ruin a good time, and we're not just out there to walk in to, you know, and check your fishing license.
Right. Yeah, good.
You're listening to Bird Calls, and we do have a couple of calls online. We're going to go next to Dennis from Marshall, Texas. Dennis, you're online with Cliff and his guest. What's your question tonight?
Well, good evening, sir. My question's actually it's related to the birds. Okay. But I'm inquiring about our squirrel population this year, and the small game. I've only been back in this area for 3 hunting seasons now. This will be my 3rd hunting season. And our squirrel population, our rabbits and such, it seems to be really low. But when I camp, myself and my son camp every weekend when we try to hunt, and at night we hear a lot of owls. And we're seeing a lot of predator birds in the woods with us. And I was just wondering if there's any type of research or anything like that going on, or if it could be an issue with why we're not seeing the small game like we have in the past.
Right. And squirrels can be fairly cyclical. We can get bumper crop years and then drought years with squirrels. And you know, you might see a lot of raptors and think, oh, it's the raptors eating them all. Well, that might work to a point, but what happens if you think they eat them all up? Then all of a sudden you got all these hungry birds. So the raptors being there is probably an indication that there is ample food, but I wouldn't think that the raptors are eating up all the squirrels. But since you're calling for Marshall, let's ask Scott here what he thinks about squirrel and rabbit numbers. You got any comments for him?
Well, so I've been a Texas game warden for 6 years, and I've been stationed in Harrison County and in Marshall for all of those 6 years. And I have seen what you said. I've seen bumper crops of squirrels and rabbits, and then I've seen a decline. So I grew up in Nacogdoches, Texas, my whole life, and moved to Marshall. So I've been in East Texas my entire life, and I've seen, you know, just large numbers of both animals rise and fall. And it seems like it's on anywhere from a 3 to 5 year hill, if you will. And so when I first got here, I didn't see many squirrels at all. So that was in September of 2012. And so at about 14, 15, there was a lot of numbers of squirrels and rabbits. And then now it seems like there's still more than there was in 2012. And it just from what I've seen, I'm not by no means a biologist or an expert, but it just seems that we might be easing back down, you know, as far as numbers. Mm-hmm. Just for my personal patrol, I guess, if you will, out and just looking while I'm out. So, like I said, not a biologist, don't have counts or accurate numbers or anything, just what I see.
And we don't monitor squirrels for the most part, Dennis, but I think that you could just be seeing this cyclical nature of peaks and valleys that Scott was mentioning. It could be just that valley point right now, but that means just wait a little bit. It'll get back up there, and you might have that bumper crop year soon.
And we have one more caller, Nita from Atlanta. You've got to get your question in quick. We're running out of time.
My husband and I, we have several ponds on our property, and we have wild geese that come in the and I've noticed that there's fewer of them. And I've noticed that when they have their babies sometimes just disappear. So I think it may be the coyotes, and we have bobcats. Is there anything we can do to make a safe place for them, like such as build a floating shelter and cover it with grasses and things? Is that legal? Can you do that?
Well, let's start by trying to figure out what geese you have, because Texas and Louisiana are not really breeding grounds for geese. So I have a sneaking suspicion that you've got some domesticated birds. They're not wild and wary, because geese in general, if we're talking about Canada geese, cackling geese, snow geese, Ross's geese, these all nest way to our north and not here locally. Now, there are exceptions. We have people that put out Canada geese, but they're truly not wild and wary. They're not supposed to be here. But no, you can modify your private property to encourage this to happen. You can put wood duck boxes up. I would say try putting wood duck boxes up and try to get the correct waterfowl that breeds in our area to nest there. So that's something to think about, Nita. Put up some wood duck boxes, and I think you'll enjoy watching those wood ducks.
You have been listening to Bird Calls, and Cliff, we're running out of time here, and it is time to go to our Conservation Minute for this show. And what do you got for us this week?
Okay, this is more of a personal tip, and it has to do with protecting your ears. Seasoned bird watchers quickly learn that knowing bird songs aids in detecting and identifying birds. Using your ears to locate birds is a lot easier and faster than relying on your eyes. You'll identify many more birds by sound than by looking for the needle in the haystack. Think about a dense forest in spring with tall trees full of leaves. That tiny songbird is up there singing high in the canopy, and you'll rarely be able to see it in order to identify it. Don't let a lifetime of loud noises at work and home ruin your hearing. No matter your age, start protecting your ears by wearing earplugs or earmuffs when shooting firearms or using loud machinery. This includes commonly used equipment at home like lawnmowers, leaf blowers, chainsaws, and table saws, because prolonged exposure to these loud items can cause substantial hearing loss. Protecting your hearing will allow you to listen to more than just the birds later in life, including your spouse, your grandkids, the television, and your pets. If you can no longer hear the birds, you may give up on some of your favorite outdoor pursuits like birding, hunting, and hiking. So protect your hearing. Do it for the birds.
All right. And Cliff and Troy and Scott, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks, guys. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
You have been listening to Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and he is a statewide ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. We'd like to thank everyone from the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department for their help for this program. Tonight's program is made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana, and in part by the Piney Woods Audubon Society of Nacogdoches Lufkin, educating people and protecting birds for over four decades. The Piney Woods Audubon Society is seeking new members and meets the first Thursday of each month, September through May. Information is available on Facebook at East Texas Piney Woods Audubon. Thanks again to our guests, both of which are state game wardens, for coming in tonight. This has been Bird Calls from Red River Radio. Our producers are Bill Beckett and Cliff Shackelford, with help tonight from Wally Derleth and Sheila Lawrence. Sound files for this program will be posted on our website in a short time. And tonight's profile speaks species was provided by xenocanto.org and was recorded by Paul Marvin. This month's bird photo was snapped by James Childress. And our next show will be on December 11th. This is Red River Radio, and we are KDAQ, Shreveport-Bossier City, KLSA, Alexandria, Pineville, KBSA, El Dorado, Magnolia, and KLDN, Lufkin, Nacogdoches.